Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. How do you get around? To work, to school, to the gym, the movies, to run errands, or to see friends? When I go to work in the morning, I often drive.
It's green, people. All right, you can do it.
But I also bike a lot.
Riding on a protected bike lane, which is nice. Makes you feel more secure, sort of tucked out of the way. Sure, you can hear the traffic whizzing by me.
And of course, sometimes it's just easier to walk somewhere. Each mode of transportation comes with its own risks and safety challenges. And we asked around, what are your biggest concerns in terms of road safety?
I would say my biggest safety concern when driving is when people act as if others are supposed to make way for them, and so they're a little bit more reckless or they're a little bit more aggressive.
People cut me off as close as possible to my car and give me a heart attack.
When I'm biking in the bike lane, as I should be and allowed to do, a driver will just completely cut in without using their turn signal, and I have to come to a dead stop as quickly as possible so I don't just slam face first into a Ford F-150.
The other pet peeve as a pedestrian is when cars stop too late and they stop in the middle of the crosswalk, and then when I give them a dirty look, they look back at me like I did something wrong.
I also hate it when drivers are just on their phones and they're looking down and not actually looking toward the direction that they're driving and around at their surroundings. It's so dangerous, it's so scary, and it's super unsafe.
And I'm clearly going straight and the other person's in the left lane, but as soon as the light turns green, they want to speed ahead and get ahead of me. Like, bro, you knew you needed to go straight way back when. Why did you wait till now?
We often get annoyed at other people's behavior when we're on the go. And of course, behavior is important. But so much of road safety is about design. How streets or highways are built can influence how fast drivers are going, the overall flow of traffic, and how well different modes of transportation coexist on one street. Road design affects how we get around, how long our commutes take, and how much we enjoy being out and about. But the stakes here really go beyond that. Thousands of people are killed in traffic accidents every year. Many more are injured. On today's episode, a look at road safety and what researchers are learning about it. First up, remember the early days of the pandemic when there was so little traffic? I remember feeling much more relaxed while driving back then, not stressed out. But motor vehicle deaths actually surged during the first year of the pandemic. Per mile driven, the number of deaths rose more than 20%, according to federal data. Nearly 40,000 people died in accidents in 2020. How did this happen, even when far fewer drivers were on the road? Reporter Jad Slayman looked into what this says about our roadways.
America's roadways apparently got much more dangerous during the pandemic. I figured I would start looking into how that happened by visiting the most dangerous street in my city. That's Roosevelt Boulevard in Northeast Philadelphia. Pre-pandemic, it claimed more lives than any other roadway in the city. It's almost ludicrously wide, kind of like a highway, but in the middle of a city. You've got row homes, people's front porches just feet from the curb, and there are turnoffs to people's driveways, to stores and restaurants. And there are cars absolutely blazing up and down its length. I'm at a part of the road where it takes pedestrians four lights to cross it. Kelly Yemen is director of the Office of Complete Streets for the City of Philadelphia.
You want to drive it like you're driving the interstate, but it's not an interstate. And it's not designed like an interstate. It's designed more like a parkway. So you've got this mismatch of of all these different design elements, again, because it kind of grew organically, that have led to this dangerous situation.
She says the boulevard, as most people here call it, wasn't intended to be the monstrosity it is today. It grew bit by bit, growing wider over the decades. I ask her about these national trends, the jump in traffic deaths. She tells me here in Philly, it was worse, much worse. We saw an 80% jump.
We know that speeding is very related to the survivability of a crash. If a crash is to occur at 20 miles an hour, there's a 10% chance that somebody will die. At 40 miles an hour, that jumps to 90%. So as speeds increased, as the roads were more open and people were able to go faster in their vehicles, whether it was a vehicle running off the road, a vehicle-on-vehicle crash, or a vehicle hitting a pedestrian, those were all more deadly.
Kelly thinks what happened is fewer people were driving, so people drove faster. Traffic, as much as we might hate it, functioned like a safety system. With so many people staying home, that system shut off.
Our roadways are designed to operate for, you know, peak hour commuting behavior so that people can get to and from where they need to go, especially at those kind of crush periods where we have a lot of people on the roadways. It's why we also see roadway fatalities tend to spike at night and overnight hours where we, again, have open roadways.
At higher speeds, experts say your field of attention as a driver narrows. You see less of what's on the periphery of the road, focusing farther down the length of it. And of course, at higher speeds, your window for reacting to a car pulling out or a pedestrian is reduced. It's a fatal recipe for collisions. Kelly says the city noticed a huge spike in fatalities starting around July 2020 as restrictions loosened. That is, except for on this one notorious roadway. The fatalities spiked everywhere except for on Roosevelt Boulevard.
Roosevelt Boulevard is, you know, by far our most dangerous roadway with the highest number of crashes, fatal crashes. But at the same time as COVID and the transportation world in general was changing, things were changing on the boulevard, and automated speed enforcement was installed and became operational in June 2020. So we had a warning period out for 2 months, and then ticketing began in August of 2020. So right as we were seeing the peaks and the spikes in the rest of the city, we had a beginning of leveling off on the boulevard.
It's not as if officials saw the carnage of pandemic-fueled fatalities coming. They were just as surprised as anyone. It was just dumb luck, it turns out, that the cameras went up a month before the fatal crashes should have. It took years for those cameras to get installed, and it also took tragedy.
So what the witnesses had said was all they could see was all this debris going up in the air in the road, not realizing, that it was my niece and the kids. They got thrown so far.
That's LaTanya Bird. She works in administration for a technical school, but she's had this other full-time job for years, advocating for a safer boulevard. She was drafted into this fight when she lost her niece, Samira Banks, and three of Samira's children, Samir, Sashan, and Sadim. They were killed by a speeding car while crossing the boulevard in 2013.
They were on their way home. They were walking, and no cars.
Samira held one child and pushed another in a stroller. Sadim had been just ahead of the group.
So Sadim was like, I want to be with my mommy. So he ran back to be with Samira.
The car struck the family moments later, right at the edge of the road.
Samira, based on AID, the Accident Investigation Division, their data, she only needed like one more step.
LaTanya has been telling this story for years, to reporters like me, to lawmakers in the city and in the state capitol. Local politicians and a bicycle coalition heard her story and asked her to help lobby.
And I want people to know, when you hear a crash or accident, don't just think it's just, it happens. No, these are people. Her body was mangled. It was so bad.
The story is not an easy one for her to tell. Even after all this time, after telling it so many times.
And there was a video that the car dealership there had. And it was like the stroller, because the stroller was like this. So when he hit the force, my niece and the baby went that way. And I don't know, I don't know where Sardine went, and that still bothers me to this day.
She calls what happened a kind of violence, traffic violence. It's a term I hadn't heard before, but I can understand it hearing the story of her family. The unsympathetic, uncompromising physics of a ton and a half of metal and glass striking the human body at high speed. LaTanya has seen it, and she can't unsee it. She has the Citizen app, which tells her anytime there's a crash nearby. Her friends tell her to delete it, because every ping gives her that same sinking feeling, knots in her stomach.
It's hard for people, you know. It's just a feeling you get. Like, you get, like, I have chills now, and it's just a whole thing that comes over your body when you think about it.
LaTanya helps run a support and advocacy group for people who have lost loved ones on the road. Like LaTanya, many of them never gave our roadway designs a second thought before whatever tragedy befell them occurred. Daniel Harriges is an urban planning expert and editor-in-chief for Strong Towns, a website and advocacy organization.
There's kind of a truism that the ultimate mark of success of an ideology is to not even be recognized as an ideology, to just be as invisible as, you know, water is to a fish. And I think that that is what has happened with some of the assumptions of the automobile era.
He's talking about the way we don't really think about poor road design in our everyday lives. He calls these arterial throughways like Roosevelt Boulevard strodes. It's a portmanteau of street and roads. Strodes, he said, are like the futons of motorway design.
Because in the same way that a futon is an uncomfortable couch that turns into an uncomfortable bed, a strode is bad at being a street and it's bad at being a road. It's this middle ground that does nothing well. The idea is that we have two different functions for these public thoroughfares in cities, and we don't often distinguish between them very well.
A road, the way Daniel uses the term, should be something like a highway. Cars moving quickly with on and off ramps, gentle curves, no intersections. A street is like your slow neighborhood lane, lined with driveways, with people's houses, restaurants, or cafes. Strodes, the kind of unholy combination of the two, end up being pseudo-highways within cities, where speed meets traffic lights and turnoffs. Whether you live in a city or small town or out in the country, you probably have a strode. You can tell you're on one, Daniel says, if you don't feel comfortable walking alongside it or, heaven forbid, trying to cross it.
They're ubiquitous because everybody's using the same engineering manuals, and there's sort of a conventional wisdom in the traffic engineering profession that arose during the early years of mass motor vehicle ownership. You know, the 1930s, the 1940s, cars are becoming this ubiquitous thing that everybody in the middle class has. And engineers become confident that they can re-engineer the city and re-engineer our transportation system around this assumption of mass car ownership.
That meant designing streets for one thing, speed, maximum automobile speed.
But the fundamental insight that I think people don't automatically have is that the purpose of many, many streets in our cities should not be to move cars. Cars are allowed on them. They do move cars, but that's not their fundamental function.
The organization Daniel works for, Strong Towns, has been lobbying against the strode for years, before the pandemic, where data showed they accounted for the lion's share of deaths. Another advocacy group, Smart Growth America, says not only have they been bemoaning the strode for years, they saw the upticks in deaths coming. They knew it would happen if the strode was opened up, free of the traffic that acts as a speed bump.
When you put your thumb so thoroughly on the scale for the people trying to jet through the community, knowing that there are a lot of folks that need to move around often on foot within that community, it's a marvel to me that the result is a surprise to anyone.
That's Smart Growth America's Vice President Beth Osborne. I told her about Roosevelt, how the traffic fatalities stayed stable after the speed cameras were installed. She says the fact that fatalities still stayed high speaks to this bigger problem with speed itself. Like, forget about reducing speeding. We need to reduce the speed limit.
And as a society, we are not ready to grapple with if you're going to insist on high speeds for your driving pleasure, for your sense or perception of convenience, then you have decided safety is your lowest priority, full stop. That's just physics.
Her organization is studying pedestrian deaths during the pandemic and why they also shot upwards. Walking became one of the few things you could do outside of your house during lockdown. The problem is, she says, that a lot of people stepped out for that fresh air only to realize that their towns, cities, or neighborhoods were not very walkable.
So there was interest in walking everywhere, but areas that were safer before stayed safer, and areas that were less safe before got much more dangerous.
She makes the point, though, that strodes like Roosevelt only make up some 15% of roadways, despite accounting for so many deaths. That means, she says, they're a good place to start. LaTanya, who lost her niece and her young children, says after this pandemic year where so many people lost loved ones, there may finally be some will to change things.
So the community is saying, hey, we need this in our neighborhood. Now, before they might say, oh, we don't need that. But now it's hitting home. Like, it hit home for us 9 years ago.
More people are seeing what she sees when she looks at streets like Roosevelt Boulevard, seeing the true cost of speed. She hopes. She's going to keep advocating for safer streets, telling her story to anyone who will listen.
You know, I haven't gotten paid a dime for anything, and I do this because I feel like I have to. And I have to do it because I know my niece. I know Samira, Sadim, Sashawn, and Samir did not die in vain.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. Coming up, experts say a different way to merge is safer and faster. So why are drivers reluctant to try it?
Sometimes cars who don't want you to get ahead of them will just turn their car so that they block you.
That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about road safety. People make mistakes on the road, no matter what mode of transportation they're using, and the stakes are high. Good road design can make a major difference, slowing down traffic, giving clear cues to drivers, cyclists, and pedestrians. Bevan Kearley and Wes Comfer are looking for ways to make our roads safer. They work together at the University of North Carolina Highway Safety Research Center. Wes focuses on crash analysis and safety education, and these issues are always on his mind.
And my wife gives me a very hard time about it. I'll point something out and say, oh, hey, that was a neat roundabout or something like that. And she'll, you know, roll her eyes because I'm talking like a traffic safety person.
Bevan agrees her work always travels with her.
It's hard to turn off what you know. And, you know, simply a trip to the grocery store can bring up a question for me on like, huh, I didn't think about this, or this is something I observed that was a little bit different.
Bevan studies how human behavior impacts our driving, and she says our behavior is guided by two different systems, conscious and unconscious.
People often incorrectly assume that most of our behavior is a result of this conscious process, but in reality, most of our behavior is actually unconscious. You know, you probably have experienced this yourself when you're driving and something unexpected happens in front of you. You know, maybe the car in front of you breaks suddenly or something like that. In this situation, you react, you know, nearly instantaneously, and you brake or swerve or do whatever's appropriate to avoid hitting the other vehicle. In that moment, you didn't have time to think about kind of option A or option B. You just react, and it's a near instantaneous reaction. So a lot of that goes into kind of, we have to think about those sorts of principles of human behavior when we're kind of talking about highway safety and how highway safety and human behavior interact.
And tell me about some of the things that you look out for to keep the system safe, even when drivers make mistakes. What helps in that regard?
I would say two of the big things that we talk about in safe system science would be separation in space and separation in time. And so if you think about who is using the roadway, whether it's someone walking across the street or someone biking down the street, they are going to be safer if they do not come into vehicular traffic. Obviously, that's not always practical to create. And if we want a really egalitarian transportation system, I don't think we can entirely separate people who are walking or biking or pushing strollers or riding in wheelchairs, that sort of thing, from the transportation system. And so the other idea is to separate them in time, meaning that there are traffic signals or other sort of facilities that make sure that people can cross intersections or cross roadways safely. And this also goes into the idea of slowing vehicular traffic down. This is one of the big challenges in the United States is our vehicle fleet is pretty large. We have a lot of heavy vehicles that can go very fast and they have a lot of horsepower. And so part of trying to keep people safe is also trying to slow down the vehicle fleet.
Slow down how much?
Well, that is a very good question and a bit of a complicated one. So if you are thinking about vibrant city life where you want a lot of people walking and biking, then probably the safe speed would be 20 miles per hour or so. Now, that doesn't mean that all transportation systems, all roadways need to be at that speed. So if you have what we call access controlled roadways, which are places where you don't have a lot of entrances or exits and you can just have vehicular traffic, you know, traveling in their own lanes without coming into conflict with other people, you can have much higher speeds still safely, generally speaking, at those kinds of facilities. It's really where people are coming into contact with each other where we need to be very careful.
And Wes, what are some design measures that maybe I'm taking for granted that have really made a change in how safe our roads are? You know, there are so many things that are going on that were put there, but I'm encountering them all the time. I probably don't even notice them anymore.
Sure. A very simple one that I'm a huge fan of, and I will, you know, shout out to the moon and back that I love is roundabouts. And roundabouts, obviously, we encounter them quite a bit when we're driving. They seem very simple, but they're super effective because they calm traffic. As you're approaching a roundabout, you slow down naturally, but then they also change the way that people come into contact with each other. So you have much less, unless someone is just flying over a roundabout, you have much less potential to, say, hit someone, T-bone them as you're going through it. And you're going through the roundabout much slower, and so it changes the angle of crashes that can happen, and it changes the speed involved in crashes. And so while people can still be involved in crashes and roundabouts, they tend to be much, much less severe. You know, anything that slows vehicles down and changes the angle of collisions between vehicles really can provide a lot of benefit.
I always thought roundabouts were really annoying as a driver, to be honest, but I get it now. They really slow you down, and I can see their purpose. Wes and Bevan also told me about some subtle cues that have an impact on driver speed.
You know, are the lanes wide? Is there good visibility? How many lanes are there? You know, things like that. The actual road structure itself is going to give you cues. And you're also going to get cues from the people around you, be it other drivers or pedestrians and things like that on the road. You know, are people traveling faster than you on the road? That may indicate that you're not going the speed that everybody else is going. Is there somebody behind you that's kind of giving you that maybe social pressure that makes you feel like you need to go faster?
We also know that environments that make drivers feel like they're hemmed in can actually cause people to slow down. And so these can be things like very closely spaced buildings or a lot of trees on the side of the road. I think Bevan even showed me a research study where someone was saying that the number of trash cans along the side of the road had a little bit of a visual friction element to it. And so we, as engineers and planners who are trying to look at the entire roadway, we can do things like traffic calming to cause people to slow down. We can also think about the cues that they're getting from the environment that can cause them to slow down. And even some studies have shown that if you change even just the posted speed limit, like if you lower the posted speed limit, that can cause some changes in at least speeding behavior, if not all of the traffic flow speed itself.
And researchers are always experimenting with ways to slow down traffic. One new approach is called optical speed bars. Picture horizontal white stripes going up the sides of a lane. the bars start out at about 1 foot apart from each other, but then the distance between them decreases.
And so what happens is as you're kind of going through these painted lines, they actually trick your brain into thinking that you're going faster than you actually are. And so it makes you feel like you need to slow down. It's an environmental cue that makes you feel uncomfortable with your speed. And so you instinctively slow down.
When a new traffic pattern comes into being, when a road is redesigned, what has to happen to make sure that people are on board with the change and can follow it, that, you know, there aren't any more accidents happening now because something is new?
You know, anytime there's something new, there's the potential for people to react in unexpected ways. And so that's why, you know, research and investigation is so important for making sure that what we are doing is going to benefit people. But on top of that, road designs have to be intuitive. You know, there's room for innovation, there's room for creativity, but you can't have something that's so different that people need instructions on how to navigate it. If you think about any one intersection in your city, you know, and think about how many people are navigating that intersection in a day or in a year or in 10 years, you can't expect to be able to explain that intersection to people. It has to be an intuitive process.
That's Bevan Kearley and Wes Kumpfer. They are researchers at the University of North Carolina's Highway Safety Research Center. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find our show wherever you get your podcasts. So, as we just heard, getting drivers to adapt to new patterns can bring some challenges. And our next story is about one such example. There is an empirically safer and more efficient way for drivers to merge in a situation where one lane ends and all the cars have to move to the remaining lane. It's called the zipper merge. But despite years of promotion, it remains controversial and not something that drivers commonly use. Why is that? Alan Yu looked into it.
You may have already heard of the zipper merge, or the late merge, from promotional videos in various states.
Zipper merges, the nicest way to handle merging.
We encourage you to do the zipper merge.
Efficiency at its finest. Spread the word on the zipper merge and let's keep our traffic on the move.
Imagine you're driving down the highway. The lane you're on is about to end because of construction. What do you do? You could change to the remaining lane as soon as possible to form one long line of cars, or you could use the lane that is ending for as long as possible to form two shorter lines, which is what experts recommend. Then at the point of the merge, drivers should merge one after the other. If you imagine looking down on this, it looks like a zipper closing, hence the name. Depending on your point of view, drivers who ride the empty lane all the way to the end are either more rational and efficient.
People who are experts in making highways and knowing how traffic should flow decided that this is the length the lane should be. It is there for you to use it.
Or they're rude jerks trying to jump the line and therefore deserve punishment.
Sometimes cars who don't want you to get ahead of them will just turn their car so that they block you.
Angela Cherry lives in Seattle. She uses the zipper merge. Her husband does not. She says after 15 years of living in Seattle, she has yet to find a more divisive topic.
People are very passionate about it, and either they think it's the right way to do it or it's the wrong way to do it.
Years of traffic research supports the drivers who do the zipper merge. Merging at the last moment makes full use of both lanes. When cars merge one after another and take turns, changing lanes is more predictable and therefore safer. It takes out the guesswork and chance. And when everyone does it, and it works well, it feels good, says Brian Crossley.
It is that kind of zen moment when you see that cohesiveness and you see traffic understanding and traffic operating in a way that you had envisioned.
He oversees traffic control at work zones for the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. Brian has been at the department for almost 20 years. The department has been trying to get people to use the zipper merge in work zones for that long. Pulse producer Nicole Curry and I drove around Philadelphia to try this out. First on a busy highway known for bottlenecks and traffic jams. When it worked, it was great.
Wow, this really would help traffic. Look at all this room I have.
Yeah.
Oh, this guy's gonna let me in. Wow, thank you.
Oh, nice. But of course, there is a reason why people are reluctant to do it, which we found out when we tried it again on the expressway through the heart of the city.
Damn. Okay, no one's letting me in.
Well, bad for you, good for the story.
Okay, calm down. Oh my god.
Departments of transportation in the US will often cite countries in Europe as examples of places that do the zipper merge well. As far as I know, European drivers are not preternaturally more rational and efficient, so how did those countries get it right? Yin Yu lives in the Netherlands and has been driving for more than 30 years. He drives more than 60 miles round trip to work every day. And he remembers what it was like before the zipper merge was a thing.
If you want to merge, you need to watch out. Usually you slow down a bit and you wait a bit and then you merge, and then congestion will start on your own lane. If it's kind of rush hour, then your own lane is already quite busy. Your whole lane will be blocked by people who try to merge into the other lane.
About two decades ago, the Dutch government started promoting the zipper merge. They ran ads on TV, much like their counterparts in the US. But they also added special signs with the word zip in Dutch to remind drivers to use the zipper merge. After a few years of promotion, they made this a law. Drivers in the remaining lane are required to let merging drivers in.
What they'll do is they'll send a policeman on a motorbike. If you're caught, you could be fined.
Yin says this made a big difference, especially in the Netherlands, a small country with a lot of curved roads, so it's hard to see far ahead of or behind you when you're driving.
It's 100% easier, and to my feeling, also safer.
However, even though Dutch drivers are required to let merging drivers through, Yin says he still chooses to merge early and would rather let others in.
As being human, 90% of us will try to merge at the beginning of the merging lane, because the most of us will think that you signal and then you merge on the main lane and get it over with.
So even in countries where late mergers cannot be punished and the zipper merge is the law of the land, drivers still prefer to merge early because anything else just feels wrong.
When people take advantage of, okay, I'm just going to speed down the right empty lane until the very end and then stop for a bit and then put my left signal and try to merge to the left lane, I get annoyed.
That's Hario Priembodo. He lives and drives in Sweden. What Hario said about being annoyed at drivers who merge late is something I heard from a lot of people. And it is the key mental obstacle holding us back from the full potential of a world where everyone does the zipper merge. It is hard to get over the feeling that merging late is just rude, says Jake Loesch, Director of Communications at the Minnesota Department of Transportation.
I don't know, Alan, if you've ever heard the term Minnesota nice before, but this is a sort of thing that we deal with a lot, where I think people are trying to be nice, so they don't want to merge, they don't want to cut the line or skip ahead. And I admit, as someone who was born and raised in this state, I have that same feeling.
His colleague, State Work Zone Engineer Michelle Moser, is not hung up on that. Among other things, her work involves managing people who direct traffic at work zones. But she says some other people are. She saw it happen just a few weeks ago.
We had a big backup in the one lane and a few people zooming up to cut in right at the merge point. I was actually the passenger, and so I was a little frustrated that the person that was driving was too timid, and she did admit that she was too timid to go over into that lane and utilize it. So she dubbed herself the weak gazelle and said that she was just going to stay in that lane.
So how can traffic engineers get more people to use the zipper merge? And that means how can they get people to be more comfortable with jumping the line and merging at the last minute? I put the question to Marie Helwig Larsen. She has actually studied line jumping, not in drivers, but some of the same principles might apply. She's a psychologist at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. Back in 2008, she published a study of line jumping among people who wanted to get tickets for the band U2. These were serious lines outside an arena. people stayed in them for hours, sometimes overnight. She found that people cared about line jumping even if it did not affect them, such as someone cutting a line behind them. People cared more about this if they had already been waiting for a long time, or they really, really wanted to see you too. So with that said, Marie says the problem with the zipper merge is that traffic engineers need to get people to temporarily suspend a well-reinforced social norm that jumping a line is bad.
So if the social norm in all freeways in Pennsylvania is to merge ahead of the merge, even if it's slightly less efficient, it requires, honestly, a lot of people's cognition and effort to now understand that because the lane is closed due to construction, you should have a different behavioral strategy for approaching the merge.
She says this can be done, but for a start, states need better signs.
I do not ever recall having been told, stay in your lane and merge at the end by taking turns, which is actually a fairly straightforward instruction, right? There's a merge coming up. We want you to do two things. Don't change lanes and take turns at the end.
Getting people to buy into the zipper merge is hard, though. She says even when the line jumping does not affect someone personally, they still feel threatened by it, because it is a threat to a long-established social norm that people need to wait their turn. Which is why drivers can sometimes respond very badly to people merging late, even if it is more efficient, and the impact is ultimately as inconsequential as spending 30 fewer seconds in traffic.
Okay, I can literally not get over, like...
That story was reported by Alan Yu, and thankfully, a kind driver eventually stopped to let our producer, Nicole Curry, merge. Coming up, we get to the bottom of potholes and why there are so many of them.
It's water and it's loading. It's the cars and the trucks that pass over the top of the pavement.
That's next on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about road safety. I have reporter Liz Tung with me in the studio right now. And Liz, you were riding your bike a couple of months ago in Philadelphia, and then you hit a pothole. What happened next?
So it was basically like I hit a brick wall. Like, I've never had an accident like this before. I basically flew over my handlebars. I was like airborne, and then I landed on my right knee and my arm.
Did you not see the pothole, or were you unable to avoid it?
No, I totally missed it. I didn't see it at all. I had no idea what had happened until I was able to go back and inspect it.
And how hurt were you?
So in the moment, it was kind of hard to tell. Some good Samaritans came out to help me, and I was super embarrassed. I was just like, I'm fine. And I grabbed my bike and I hobble over to a stoop in the shade because it was also super hot. And once I got there, I was in so much pain that I thought I had like cracked my kneecap. Ugh. And so I'm sitting there and I'm doing slow breathing so that I don't like pass out. And then finally I was, you know, okay enough to get up and ride my bike away. But incredibly, no, I didn't have any serious injuries. I just had like a big bruise and some road rash on my arm.
Yeah, and you're really lucky you still have all your teeth.
Yes.
Because like, with that kind of injury, that's like, ah.
I know.
So since that day, you've been on a bit of a quest to find that pothole that brought you down, and also to understand more about how potholes come into existence, like what causes them. What have you learned?
My quest started on a hot afternoon in South Philly.
Okay, everybody, keep your eyes peeled for potholes.
I wanted to see the original pothole that caused my crash. In tow were my husband and his mom, who was visiting from England, and frankly seemed scandalized by the state of our streets.
There is quite a big patch in the road here where it would be easy to come off your bike.
As it turns out, there are potholes everywhere.
Is that a pothole? That was definitely a pothole. That was probably a pothole.
That's my husband, Wooly.
If you're going to be counting every little thing, you're going to run out of fingers very quickly.
Along the way, we documented the taxonomy of potholes, from little dips in the road to huge patched areas.
We're just passing by a huge hole in the concrete that has now been filled with rocks and trash and a cone.
I realized that the pothole I was looking for had plenty of neighbors.
I wonder if that's it. I mean, it's really like every 15 feet, there's like a big patch.
If I wasn't going to find my pothole, I at least wanted some answers. So I got in touch with Steve Lorenz, the chief highway engineer for Philadelphia's streets department.
How big a part of your job is dealing with potholes?
Every day. Every day.
As much as I'd like to blame the city for all the potholes, the fact is, Steve says, they're doing the best they can. The streets department fills literally thousands of potholes every year.
We try to be proactive, you know, but it's very challenging.
He says part of the challenge is the climate.
We have this constant freeze-thaw.
Here's what happens. When it rains, water trickles down through cracks in the roadway. It then seeps into the layers below, and of course, when water freezes, it expands, breaking up the brittle asphalt. For a more detailed explanation of what's going on, I hit up Rick Nelson. He's a longtime engineer who now heads up the Snow and Ice Cooperative Program for the American Association of State and Highway Transportation Officials, or AASHTO. Rick started off by breaking down the anatomy of our roadways.
There's the top layer, which is asphalt or concrete. That's the piece that you drive on.
Asphalt and concrete are both made from a mix of sand and crushed rocks. Where they differ is the binding agent. Concrete is made with cement, while asphalt is held together with a petroleum-based binder. These days, asphalt is often used to top roads because it's way cheaper, faster to lay down, and easier to repair. It's also more flexible. So even though it deteriorates faster than concrete, asphalt can handle that freeze-thaw cycle a little bit better because it's got some flex. Concrete, on the other hand, is sturdier and lasts longer, but more brittle. So anyway, that's the top layer.
Underneath that is what we call the base, and that's the foundation.
Sort of like the foundation of a house. That's made from a mix of crushed rock.
And then underneath that is like the native soil, the virgin material that's there under the pavement.
Rick says there are two main things that cause these layers to break down.
It's water and it's loading. It's the cars and the trucks that pass over the top of the pavement.
When cracks appear in the pavement, and they always do, water gets down into the foundation and freezes. That causes the cracks to expand.
And so, you know, it pushes up on that pavement, and it makes that crack a little bigger. And when it melts, it sort of flows away the fine materials and creates a void, a gap underneath that pavement. And then when the traffic goes over it again, it pushes that pavement down, and next thing you know, you have a pothole.
There was just one thing I didn't get. I thought concrete and asphalt were, you know, solid. Even if you have cracks in the top layer, how much room could there be down there for water to collect? As it turns out, there's one more factor, which I heard about from Luna Liu, a professor at Purdue University's Lyell School of Civil Engineering. And that factor is air pockets.
When it's freezing, the water expands, right? That will create an internal force to push the material apart. And then with melting, it will create a void that will trap the air.
But these pockets aren't just created by water freezing. They're part of the concrete itself.
The concrete actually has, you know, cement, water, your aggregates, right? And then you definitely need the air voids there. Why? Because you need a concrete to expand and contract.
Because of changing temperatures, which means that you need a bit of space in there for the concrete to move. Otherwise, you'll get internal stress that'll end up cracking the material.
Typically outside, you want to have more air voids rather than inside, you have less air voids. Again, because air voids will reduce the strength of the material, right? So you don't want to have too much, but you don't want to have zero.
So quick recap, rain seeps into the cracks in the pavement. It flows down into the base and sub-base of the roadway. When it gets cold, the water freezes, expanding and causing the cracks to get bigger. When it gets warm, the water melts and the debris flows away, leaving pockets in the pavement. Pre-existing pockets cause even more vulnerability. Then you've got 10,000-pound trucks driving over those weak points, and boom, pothole. Luna says potholes aren't just a pain, they're an expensive, dangerous pain.
The data has been showing the cost of the repairing potholes in the United States anywhere ranging from $2.5 billion to $3 billion. What that translates is about $600 per driver per year just to fix the repair of related to the damage caused by the potholes.
Plus, the cost drivers have to pay for damage to their cars or, worst case scenario, hospital bills, and how much cities have to pay out for lawsuits. Right now, for example, Detroit is facing a $10 million lawsuit from a guy who hit a pothole, resulting in a traumatic brain injury. Meanwhile, in New York City, an audit a few years ago found that over 6 years, the city paid $138 million to settle their pothole-related lawsuits. So obviously, it's in everyone's best interest to repair, or better yet, prevent potholes from forming in the first place. According to Rick Nelson, the key to dealing with potholes is acting early and often.
When it comes to preventing potholes, the best thing you can do is to make sure that those cracks are sealed up. Every place there's a crack and a seam, there's a potential for water to get down in there and work that against that foundation and cause that pothole to form.
Once you get past the crack stage, you've got to invest in actually patching the pothole using asphalt. But Rick says you can't wait too long.
And if you defer that maintenance, you know, at some point, you can't just patch that pothole anymore. You have to completely redo the pavement.
Which is way more expensive and way more time consuming. But local transportation departments don't always have the resources to seal up cracks as soon as they appear. They've got a fixed budget and lots of priorities. Facility improvements, installing new roads, sidewalks, and bike paths, public transit, accessibility ramps, and on and on. So it's tough, Rick says. But some engineers are working on bigger solutions. Luna Lu, for example, is working on smart sensors that flag up stretches of road that need to be repaired before they start breaking down. Another idea she's working on, self-healing concrete.
Concrete can actually self-heal itself through some nanoparticles reaction with the water over the time. So therefore, again, the same idea to reduce the likelihood to form the potholes over the time and also reduce the frequent repair.
Researchers across the country have their own pet projects. Concrete made with plastic or rubber for better resilience, adding bacteria to concrete that helps it resist breakdown associated with winter salting. Even drones capable of fixing potholes as they pop up. And we're going to need those solutions, because even as pothole fighting technology has improved, my panel of experts told me our roadways have been getting worse. That's because we built most of our roads in the 1950s and 60s. They're already way past the age when they were designed to be redone. And they're handling more and heavier traffic than they were ever designed to carry. That, plus population growth and climate change, means our roads are facing more pressure than they were ever supposed to handle. None of which gives me any empathy for the pothole that wrecked me. Finally, after about 15 minutes of wandering around, I found the culprit. Probably.
Okay, here, this is the one that I suspect it really might have been. And it's so small, which makes me angry because I feel like, you know, it felt like a huge friggin' hole.
I was hoping I could take a picture and get the city to fill in the hole, maybe right on the spot with me watching. But given how small the thing is, the street crews probably have much bigger and more pressing holes to worry about.
I'm fixing up. That was Liz Tong reporting. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tong, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.